chapters 8 and 9.
Yes.
So, we have now made it to the beaver's house. We have had a wonderful, homey, but filling and delicious dinner as only a pair of beavers could offer. We are now moving to what happened after dinner, the actual title of chapter 8. So it works out quite well. So would someone just kind of give us a quick jumping off point? What first happens after dinner?
They start talking about the humus.
Mr. Thomas, that's right. So now that they've eaten, they've kind of, you know, they were hungry, and they were cold, and they were everything else, and you fill your belly, and now you can take a deep breath, and we can move on, and they want to know, where is Mr. Tumnus? The first thing they did, if you recall, when they all made it into Narnia through the wardrobe, they followed Lucy's advice, go to see Mr. Tumnus, and his house has been ransacked. There's a note talking about how he's been arrested on orders of the Queen for fraternizing with humans. Who's the human he fraternized with?
Lucy.
It's all her fault. Then they were able to follow a bird. The bird led them to Mr. Beaver. Mr. Beaver brought them home and has given them kind of the barest of explanations. Kind of wanted everybody to eat, I guess, and just sort of get stuff together. And now, after dinner has ended, is kind of the time for deeper questions. Certainly they've been talking throughout dinner, and we got a little bit into their conversation last time we met, but now that dinner is complete, they've got serious matters to discuss. Both sides. You know, the kids have some serious questions, Mr. Beaver has some serious things to talk about, and after dinner seems to be the appropriate time, so the very first thing is, what in the world happened to Mr. Tumnus? So what happened?
The police came and got him.
They got him.
Took him to the
Queen's house. The castle.
That's right. That's right. So he has been arrested and forcibly taken away. He has been taken to the castle. By and large, you will not find the beavers calling her the queen. They will call her the witch.
Yeah.
If you are on her side, you call her the queen.
Yeah.
If you are not on her side, you tend to call her the witch. Yeah. And he says that this means that if Tumnus has been arrested on her orders, he's been taken to her house, and he expresses that with a lot of kind of somberness.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
That whoever goes in doesn't usually come out.
Yeah, yeah. Hotel California.
Yeah.
You check in, you cannot check out. Bad things happen.
Yeah.
Bad things happen. As a matter of fact, what does he suggest has happened to Mr. Tumnus? He thinks he may have been turned into a statue. He says her house is just full of them.
Because they want to go there, of course, to save.
I mean, that's their immediate response. You got to love these kids.
Yeah.
Their immediate response is, we've got to go.
Because you know he's a stinker.
And he's like, whoa, you can't go because this is, the power of the White Witch is significant, and it is beyond any of us, and it's beyond any of you. So just going to rescue Mr. Tumnus is not going to help.
Yeah, but Peter wants
to
dress up.
Yeah, I love,
I know, right?
I love how
she might not know
how 12-year-old Peter's plan is. Like, I got it. We're going to disguise ourselves as peddlers and knock on the door. I'll get like a mustache.
We'd like to sell you these rooms.
And he's got like this whole kind of James Bond sort of thing starting to roll off the top of his head. And Mr. Beaver's like,
no.
That's a terrible
idea.
So Mr. Beaver basically says, there is nothing that you can do. It's no good you trying, but
Aslan is on the move.
Yeah. And I told you how much that phrase has meant. It is something that will be repeated a few times. and if we consider its implications, if Aslan is the figure of Christ within this particular world, within this particular dimension or universe or however it is we're going to understand it, to hear the term Aslan is on the move should make us think Christologically about what?
Things are going to get better.
Christ is on the move. Things are going to get better. Something's going to happen. Something's going to change. Yeah. It's one thing to say, you know, well, we'll pray about it. Or I prayed, you know, Lord, help us or whatever. But if, you know, Jesus is on the move, kind of presupposes, it sort of communicates that sense of something big's about to go down. Something is happening. You know, the Holy Spirit is on the move. Gives you the impression that something about the power of God is close, is almost tangible. You know, that maybe a feeling within the environment or stirring within your heart, or maybe signs and wonders or wherever it might be. But if you've been in a worship service, in a fellowship, or just talk to somebody who was trying to describe something relatively indescribable, but about the presence of God, and said, well, the Holy Spirit was on the move, that almost gives us this sense of God's power. So Aslan is on the move. That's Mr. Beaver's response to, it's no good you trying to do something, but Aslan's on the move. How do the kids respond? Ooh, more. So, remember that beautiful passage that we did last time when he first speaks the name of Aslan? And in everyone, there's this feeling, this unsolicited, unstoppable, almost indescribable feeling that just the name of Aslan conjures up in each of the kids. None of them have any idea. They've never heard this name or this word before. But every single one of them has this very powerful internal response. You know, one of them feels brave and courageous, and one of them feels like it's the beginning of the holidays and exciting. And what does Edmund feel?
He's a different feeling, a nightmarish kind
it's
of
not,
feeling.
It's not the Christmas. It's not the dreary feeling. It's sort of a upbeat.
It is for a lot of the kids, but not for Edmund. For Edmund, he feels...
He feels like everything's going to change for him.
Edmund feels some dread.
He's scared.
Edmund feels some fear. It's like he can't put his finger on it, but he feels weird.
Yeah.
All the other kids are like, wow, and Edmund's like, ugh.
Yeah.
So...
He's supposed to be the king.
All right. Now... So they're all excited, and it says that strange feeling is overtaking each of them. And Susan asks, who is Aslan? So, who is Aslan? The Lord of the Wood.
Son of the great emperor.
Son of the great emperor over the sea.
And the only one that can change things.
The only one who can change things. So it's no secret, and it's not, I mean, it is a plot point, but it's a very open plot point, that Aslan is the figure of Christ within this world. Now, C.S. Lewis was always very twitchy when people called these stories allegories. He didn't like allegories. He thought allegories were kind of simplistic and annoying. He saw allegories as this equals this plus this equals that, and he thought that was a very low level of writing. When you just kind of, you give the same thing a new name, and then you put it in a story. And he thought this was different than that. That it wasn't so much that Aslan equals Jesus and everything that Jesus said and did, all he did was change names. He more described it as, what if there were a world that was like Narnia? What if there was a creation with these talking animals and with this white witch and everything else? How might God be manifest to his people within this context? As another animal. Yeah, right? So if the fundamental understanding of God in the world is the incarnation, the enfleshment of Jesus. So that's what incarnation means. So the carnation part, not carnation the flower, but carnation like carne, meat, in meatment. You know, Jesus has meat and flesh and a body that comes through the power of the Holy Spirit and his mother, Mary. And we acknowledge and commemorate the miracle of the Incarnation through the Nicene Creed every single Sunday. By the power of the Holy Spirit, he became incarnate from the Virgin Mary and was made. So, God is God is God is God. Whether it's this story or another, but what Lewis is trying to say is, if this world was different than ours, how might God become incarnate in that world? So, parallels, consistencies, metaphor, sure. But he was always twitchy about the allegory part of it for whatever reason. I don't know. I think I don't see how you calling an allegory is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But it always bothered him for some reason. But that's who Aslan is. So, pick out a couple of the things that Mr. Beaver uses to describe Aslan, and let's see not just how they're, you know, Aslan equals Jesus because, but more thinking through in this different world, how would God be with his people? Emmanuel, God with us. How would God be manifest? How would he be among? How would he be with the creatures of this different world?
An animal.
So he's going to be an animal because they're animals.
Yeah.
He's going to be a talking animal because they're talking animals. If Jesus takes on our flesh and our life's the incarnation, then whatever incarnation happens in this Narnia universe needs to be an animal incarnation.
And he's going to settle the white queen.
Well, he's going to settle her hash good.
Taking care of people.
That's right. That's right. So, Jesus as the Messiah is the anointed one, and he is going to conquer sin and death. So, what's Aslan's mission through this universe?
Conquer the witch.
Conquer the witch. Now, let's think about the witch for a second. I won't say allegorically out of respect for C.S. Lewis, but how can we connect the white witch with the concept of sin and death?
The white witch is
dead.
She stands for evil.
She puts evil in the world.
What she, her background, where she came,
she wasn't born of.
Right.
She was born of Jesus.
She's not human.
Not human. Okay. Think more broadly for a second. Think more broadly about what does the witch bring with her to Narnia?
Winter.
Well, I'll grab you in a second. Okay. So winter. And in the life cycle, what is winter most like?
Cold.
It's cold, it's barren, cold things don't move, they're frozen, death is frozen, there's no energy, there's no life, there's no growth, it's just like a, you know, not around here, but, you know, a place, remember what they're talking about, always winter, never Christmas, so years and years and years, decades, if not centuries, of nothing but ice and snow, it's not pretty anymore. If you've lived in a place that has snow, it's awesome for a couple of days, and then it gets very difficult, especially when it turns to ice. Snow that sits around for a while isn't fluffy and powdery.
Yes,
it's miserable. It's ice.
Miserable. Oh, and it also gets dirty and brown.
Yeah. So if winter, coldness, and stillness. Do things grow in winter?
No.
Do things live easily in winter?
No.
The white witch and sin and death, how is sin and death expressed in a Narnia universe? It's expressed through winter. Cold and death and no growth and no life and being frozen and miserable and everything else. And because of her, that's what their world looks like.
And turn to statues.
Turn to statues. Isn't that interesting that she's not straight up murdering them?
No.
She's actually freezing them in essence. It's kind of like the fullness expression of winter. You are frozen, except not just in a block of ice. Your very body has turned to immovable stone. Diane. What? You had a question.
No, I had a question and I had a comment, but it was already expressed.
Oh, we've already covered it. Oh, good. Great. So, if the mission of Christ to conquer sin and death, and the white witch is sort of sin and death within this world, coldness and winter and barrenness and everything else. So the mission of Aslan then is, as you said, it's to...
He's on the move.
He's on the move.
He's
going to make things better. He's going to conquer the white witch.
Yeah.
He's going to take care of stuff. He's going to take care of her.
Also, the beaver also points out to the kids that they're not going to be doing the saving.
Exactly.
Aslan,
they're very adventurous about it. Like, we'll go, we'll all do this. And he's like,
no.
And ultimately, as much as I love 6-year-old girls, how much life saving do they tend to do?
Not much.
So.
It's almost like what we have to do, we think we might conquer something by ourselves, but we have to pray about it and ask Jesus to help us.
Well, and who conquers sin and death? It's not through our own efforts. It's through His grace. We share in that, not because we did it, not because we fought a white witch or we fought death, but we benefit from what God has done for us, what God has done that we couldn't do. We're the 6-year-old girl in this story, where we might have good intentions, but ultimately, do we have what it takes to destroy sin and death? We don't. We rely on the power and on the mercy of God. All right, what else about Aslan can we make some connections to with Christ?
He gets on the move. Winter begins to go away.
Okay, we haven't seen that yet.
That's
but you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. We haven't seen that yet. Now, we're actually given a rhyme or a poem or a prophecy.
Wrong will be right.
Yes. Wrong will be right when Aslan comes in sight. At the sound of his roar, sorrows will be no more. When he bares his teeth, winter meets its death. And when he shakes his mane, we shall have spring again. It may not be fine poetry, but this is analogous to prophecies of Scripture. What Mr. Beaver refers to as rhymes, we could make the connection to Old Testament prophets who foretell the coming of Christ and what it will mean for us, for the world, and for eternity.
Excuse me.
So what else about the identity of Aslan? He's given a couple other explanations about who he is by Mr. Beaver. There's one in particular I'm thinking about we have not mentioned.
That he's to be feared.
And he will be. And there's a really terrific passage that I want us to talk about for a second. But there's one that I don't think we've said it. If somebody said it, I missed it.
Is he a man or is he human?
Right. And she said, no way. Because remember, this is the incarnation. Right. The incarnation in this universe needs to be an animal.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
He's a lion.
He's a lion. And that kind of makes sense as far as the incarnation is concerned. Lion of Judah, excellent biblical reference. But also, we think of lions as what? The
great
king.
The king of the beasts or the king of the jungle. Yeah. And there's this regal majesty that we associate with lions. So it's kind of a perfect little metaphor.
He's good.
He is good.
But he's not safe.
But he's not safe.
Yeah.
Who is Aslan related to?
Confused. The emperor.
The son of the
emperor.
That's not the whole title.
Oh.
Beyond the sea.
Beyond the sea. Okay, so he's the son of the emperor beyond the sea. Now, I want us to think about that for a second. First of all, what's our connection to Aslan, the son of the emperor beyond the sea, to Jesus?
It's the son of God.
Son of God. Okay, yeah, easy enough. Easy enough. Now, think about that title for a second. Emperor beyond the sea. I will, spoiler alert, tell you that you never meet the emperor beyond the sea, not in any single of the seven books. The emperor beyond the sea is always referred to as simply the emperor beyond the sea.
Now, is that action or not?
Is that like
God?
That's
God.
Yes.
It would be God.
Yes. Why emperor beyond the sea?
He's beyond the
unreachable.
Because he's unreachable.
Yes.
He's not.
We
can't
stand before him.
Right. Everybody's right on this. It makes me think of the hymn, Immortal, invisible, God only wise, and light inaccessible, hid from our eyes. So, the very nature of God is beyond us. He can reach to us, we cannot reach to him. In essence, he is beyond the sea. Not so much a geographical distance. To say something is beyond the sea is just, it's almost poetic or metaphorical. That makes sense. It's just beyond. They're not even naming a geographical location. It's just, it's beyond. It's beyond. Now, what about the title? What does that give you a hint towards? The title, emperor. Because he didn't say the king over the sea, what does he say?
The emperor.
The emperor, why? Just any thoughts? This is just a guess.
Regal.
Okay, regal.
Greatest.
He's the one that is
the
ruler.
The anchor.
Right. So.
The king of beasts.
If we consider European history and titles, honorifics, and power structures of hierarchy, kings are pretty much the top, or at least the top of their country or dominion, but an emperor is above that.
Yeah.
The emperor is in charge, is the ruler of an empire, something which stretches to basically everything that you can see and everything that you can know. The Roman Empire was considered all the known world. And if you had little tribes and little nations and little groups, and they have a king, that, you know, I'm the king of the Goths, and I'm the king of the Picts, and I'm the king of the whoever's, but the emperor was over you all. You know, think back to King Herod. Herod was allowed to maintain that title of the king of the Jews. Why? Because he was some sort of threat to the emperor or an equal? Absolutely not. The emperor saw him as a puppet, probably never gave him a second thought. But they found it an easy way to administrate because empires are so gigantically large. Let these people groups have their kings, whatever, and then the kings can answer to me, for I am the emperor. So in essence, whether, you know, she can proclaim herself as queen, even as regent of Narnia, but who is she under?
The emperor.
This is kind of like a God of all creation, God of the universe. We just did Eucharistic Prayer C, which preserves the Bracha prayer from the Jewish table blessing. Blessed art thou, O Lord God, ruler of the universe. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, emperor of all that there is. Pretty much, you could use it the exact same way.
Some of the Roman emperors declared themselves God.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there was definitely a divine component to that.
What did you say, Ben?
I said some of the Roman emperors declared themselves God.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. So, we have an emperor over everything, and he is beyond. And Aslan is his son. In essence, the contact that the Narnians will have with the emperor beyond the sea is through Aslan. And all of those who desire to see the Father only need to look at the Son. For if you have seen the Son, you have seen the fullness of the Father. So, the incarnation within this universe, within this context, is Aslan, the king of beasts, the great and mighty lion, who is the son of the emperor beyond the sea. How are we doing so far?
Good.
Now, a couple of you have already mentioned it. It's one of the best lines, most descriptive and frankly most important lines about the nature of Aslan. Is he safe?
No.
He is not safe. But
he's good.
He is good.
Good.
Okay? So, what does that mean for us?
He's going to do something good.
They have to seek him out.
He's good for us. He's going to do something good for us.
Okay. Not just in the book, but what does it mean for Aslan to not be safe, but good?
Same thing
that he is. Aslan is safe, but Aslan is not safe, but he is good.
Good. Okay.
Same thing that Christ went through and is suffering and being hung on the cross.
But sometimes the choices we have to make in order to stay following Christ are not always, don't always feel safe to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the beasts of the field and the birds of the air have a place to lay their head. The Son of Man has nowhere to rest. The answer he gives when people say, "Well, I'd like to follow you." Okay, but if you follow me, where are you going to go? If you follow me, it's going to involve you taking up what?
A cross.
And it might even involve the losing of family and friends, and it may even involve your death. So to follow Jesus is not safe. He is not Santa Claus. He is not a magic eight ball that you can shake and get an answer to. He is not an online store that you can enter in your request and it will be shipped to you in 2 days or less. He is, it's like Mr. Beaver says, well, he's the king. He's the king. He is not safe. You ever met a safe lion?
No.
If he was safe, if he were safe, what kind of lion would he be?
Cowardly lion.
Okay. Different story, but good point.
That's good.
And what is the cowardly lion? What's his big problem?
No courage.
He doesn't want to be a cowardly lion. That's no lion at all. Who's ever heard of a lion as a coward? So basically, if you are a safe lion, you are no lion at all. So for him to be fully lion, for Aslan to be fully an animal, he is not going to be safe. He is wild. He is untamable, but he is
good.
It is not safe to follow Jesus, but
he is good.
He says, learn from me. Take my yoke upon you. For my burden is easy. My yoke is light. It's going to be rest for your souls. He is trustworthy. We can depend on him. We can know that what he says and does is right. It is holy. It is gracious. It is loving. It is strong. But it's just not safe. If anyone's read the Mitford books, love the Mitford books, Father Tim and Mitford, North Carolina, great, sweet little books.
There's a new one out.
There is a new one out just from like September, totally worth reading, just kind of small town life, and Father Tim, the Episcopal priest, is kind of the hero of the story. But in basically every book, he will come to a situation where someone is in trial or tribulation, there's some kind of danger or suffering or whatever, and he says something along the lines of, well, I will say the prayer that never fails. What is the prayer that never fails? Do you remember?
Yeah.
Thy will
be
done.
That's right.
So that's the prayer that never fails.
Yeah.
Because God's will is going to be done.
Yes.
Okay? So it doesn't fail in that sense. But does that mean you're going to get what you want?
No.
Does that mean it's going to come the way you want it?
No.
No.
Does that mean you're going to be happy when it happens?
No.
No.
Sometimes.
All that is an unknown. But his will be done, and his will is good, for he is good. Not just he does good things, God himself is good. He is goodness. We have no standard to judge him by other than himself. For he is good. Just like from 1 John, God is love. We don't know love apart from the nature of God. When things are loving, it's like they are reflecting the nature of God in some way. Aslan, like Christ, is not safe. He is not tame. He is not at our beck and call. He is not a magician, nor is he Santa Claus, nor is he just giving us stuff because we're asking. But he is good, and we can trust him even when we don't like it. We can depend on him even when we don't understand it. We can count on him even when it happens in ways that we have not asked for. There's Ephesians, glory to God, whose power working in us can do infinitely more than we can ask or imagine. He's actually better than we can know. He gives us stuff. You ever have that happen? You pray for something and you get something different, but it's better. Mm-hmm. It's better than you could have asked. You didn't even know to ask for it.
Right.
I know I have, for sure, for absolute sure. I thought I knew what I wanted. I thought I knew what I needed, but what I was given was very different, and it was actually better than I could have asked for. I didn't even know to ask.
Maybe you didn't even know at the time you received it.
Maybe not. And maybe when I received it, I didn't like it.
Right.
Because he is not safe.
But he is good.
I heard a quote, too, on the radio that C.S. Lewis said, just a small, that love is vulnerable.
Absolutely.
So when we love Jesus, we become more vulnerable. And we should be.
True love presupposes an openness and a softness and an ability to be hurt. A very, very profound and beautiful quote. I think it's from The Four Loves. But C.S. Lewis writes about the impenetrable heart, where he says, to love is to have an open heart, and to have that open heart is to risk being hurt. He says, there is a way around this. You can take your heart and you can lock it up. And you can lock it up in a box and never, ever open it. But be prepared that when you do that, it's going to change. It's going to become hard. And it's going to become hard like a diamond that nothing can ever get in. It can't be broken, but it can never receive either. So, to follow God is to risk. This might even hurt. But hurt or not, I can trust him because he is good. You're a kid, your parents take you to the doctor, he pulls out that syringe.
You want to run.
Yes. You want to run. And it is not safe. But you trust that the ultimate outcome is for your good. And so you risk it because you trust your parents or you trust the doctor or you trust. Okay. All right, so.
They're going to meet him at the stone table.
Now, so they ask, so if he's going to come and he's going to fight the witch, won't the witch just turn Aslan into stone? What's Mr. Beaver's response? Because it's kind of a good one.
Is that where he tells him about where she came from?
Sort of. Not quite yet.
But she doesn't have the power to do that to him.
She can look him in the face.
No, she could barely stand.
If she can stand on her 2 feet and look him in the face, it will be the most she can do and more than I expect of her.
Yeah.
So, in theology and philosophy, there is this concept referred to as the numinous. And the numinous is intended to describe the indescribable awesome nature of God. So the numinous is something that is not human, not understandable, supernatural, and beyond us. So it's sometimes kind of like being transcendent. The numinous is that kind of indescribable quality of God's presence or the glory of God. It is transcendent, it is above us, versus immanent, which means with us. So this numinous quality, this transcendent, awesome, amazing power. Well, if I could see Jesus right now, I'd give him a great big hug. If you could see Jesus right now, you might die. You might faint. You might burst into tears and fall on your knees. Before we think that we've got a big grasp on this, remember who it is that we're talking about. And that ultimately, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I don't like a politician. Like you say you don't like the president. Well, if the president were here, I'd give him a piece of my mind. And if he stepped in the room, how many of us would go, if only for a second, I wasn't expecting to see him. But it's like any president. Like, there's just something about the office, there's something about the unexpected nature, and we can say what we want to, but in the presence of someone, sometimes it's good. So, her knees would be knocking is the thought. At the awesomeness, I think we've had this in another context about the presence of God is awful, but that's kind of it's kind of an archaism. It's an old way of using the word. Awful used to mean
full of awe.
Yeah. Like, I am going to pee my pants because I am overwhelmed. If you've seen anything truly awesome, not like the kids, awesome, but I mean something that just takes your breath away. Literally takes your breath away. You suck in. That is the barest of human experiences to be reckoned to seeing the face of God. We just had this 2 Sundays ago when the bishop was here about Moses. Moses, I want to see your face. Moses says, I want to see your face. What does God say?
No,
it can't. It'll kill you. The glory of God will kill you. And I don't want you dead. Not yet. So, he hides in the cleft of the rock. And you may see... You may see the passing of my glory.
That is so...
I know, isn't it?
So, Aslan, there is a divine nature of awesomeness to Aslan. Remember, he is incarnate. He is an animal. But he's also the son of the emperor beyond the sea. And you have both. You have one of us... And you have beyond what I can know and understand. Just to be in his presence is just this overwhelming experience. And if the witch can even stand on her own 2 feet, she's doing really well. There ain't no way she's going to turn him to stone.
Yeah, Miss Beaver said if there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking,
and that pretty much settles it right there. I mean, this is what it's like.
Right.
Either braver or more foolish than most.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
That is so.
We've got another rhyme or prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
When Adam's flesh and Adam's bones sits at Kaer Paravel enthroned, the evil time will be over and done. Kaer Paravel is the castle which should be the capital of Narnia, except once the White Witch took over, she moved the capital to her own home. And so there's a prophecy about Adam's flesh and Adam's bone. What does that mean?
Descendants
of Adam, mankind, humanity, people, humans, are going to return to Kaer Paravel, the capital castle.
An evil time will be done.
How many thrones?
Four.
Four
thrones. Dun, dun, dun. There are four thrones at Kaer Paravel. How many Pevensey children are there?
Four.
Dun, dun, dun. There are four Pevensey children.
Two daughters.
But Edmund is not with
the... Dang it, Edmund!
Oh, yeah.
He wandered off somewhere.
All right, so the kids have now realized something. What have they realized?
That Edmund's
gone. Say it, Edmund.
Yeah, you skipped over just exactly.
So, at some point, they've been just sort of lost in all this Aslan talk, and then they realize.
Where's Edmund?
Yeah.
Where the heck is Edmund?
They can't find him. And they looked everywhere.
And they can't find him.
And they said, "When did he leave?"
And so they, you know, at some point in the middle of the conversation, they do think backwards and remember who thinks maybe the White Witch can turn Aslan to stone. Who asked that question? Edmund does. Edmund does. Because that's kind of a very Edmund question. So he was there at least for that much. Not exactly sure when he left after that, but he heard at least that much. And so these plans can now, you can't trust they're a secret any longer. Because what has Edmund become? Not just lost.
He's betrayed.
He is a traitor. He has betrayed them. And what does Mr. Beaver say about his expectation of Edmund?
He doesn't trust him.
He doesn't trust him.
He didn't. He hasn't.
From the beginning. He said he had a look.
The eyes.
The eyes.
Evidently, anybody
eyes.
Who eats a lot of
the
food.
Turkey.
Well, since you all had some, I don't know. I will say, he just mentions the witch's food. And I have a very clear impression from the way that this food was enchanted, it would have been anything that he asked for. It just so happened. So maybe the Turkish fly is okay. So he says he saw it from the beginning. And the kids all thought Edmund was a real stinker. But did they ever think he would actually betray them?
No.
But he has.
Yeah.
He has. So what's the only thing the Beavers and the kids can do now?
Run. Well, we need Aslan. Run away.
Yeah. We're going to have to run because they're coming. They're going to come. They're going to come for us. We're going to run and we're going to go meet Aslan. Because what can we do about it?
Nothing.
Who's going to save us? Who's going to save Edmund?
No,
Aslan. He is our only hope. Aslan is our only hope. He's the only one who can do anything. So we need to get out of here and we need to go meet him. Where are we going to meet him?
At the stone table.
Okay, fair enough. So we've got a destination in mind, we have got a purpose in mind, and
I have another question.
Yes.
Okay, it says here that the queen, no, it says, but she's no daughter of Eve.
Yes.
That whole thing.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so she has at least claimed humanity as though she personally was fulfilling these prophecies and why she, like, this is why I am justifying me as queen and ruler. And what does Mr. Beaver say about that?
She's not.
Where'd she come from?
The first bride of
Lilith?
No. Is that true?
And the giants.
Is that true?
No. Is
what
true?
I mean,
Okay, so let's go back and let me give you a little outside of the book context.
Okay.
So, it is part of Jewish folklore that Lilith was the first wife of Adam and proved herself to be unsuitable. And different ancient mystical Jewish writings have different stories. Some of these stories were collected or were written about in English literature, which would make C.S. Lewis very, very familiar with them. And so it's kind of developed its own sort of mythology over the centuries. That it's not making a scriptural argument. It's folklore and it's mythology, and it's just kind of pulling in some interesting strands. But the thought behind it is that Lilith was intended to be the first wife of Adam, but not being human herself, she was not a suitable companion. And as a matter of fact, she argued incessantly with Adam and ran away.
How was she created?
It depends on the story. Sometimes she's actually made of the same dust as Adam. Sometimes she is of...
By God?
Yes. Sometimes she is made of... Or she is, she comes from a kind of a spiritual element like the angels and the demons. She is considered, after she runs away from Adam, she perseveres, and she becomes identified with demonic seduction. She, within this folklore, she is the seducer of men at night, the succubus, and she is the murderer of children in their cribs. So she was denied children with Adam. So she goes off and she has as many relations as possible with anything and everything, from presumably animals to angels to demons. And her offspring are the giants and the monsters and the evil, creepy things of this world. And she herself becomes a figure of horror and creepy evil. So Lilith, you know, kind of in medieval Europe, is the, you know, if a baby, especially baby boys, if they die before they are circumcised on the eighth day, if they die in the crib or if they die right after birth, Lilith was blamed because she hates children, especially male children.
Wow.
Because she is bitter and she has carried this grudge and will do so, you know, on into eternity or something like that. But anyway, Lilith is a way to connect to creation, to humanity and Adam, but not be human. Actually, anti-human. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Beaver even says, he gives this very interesting, almost deeply philosophical comment where he says, never trust anything that used to be human and isn't, should be human and isn't, tries to pretend it's human, but it isn't. Like, the closer you get to humanity without actually being a human, he said, feel for your hatchet. Watch your wallet. You know, because there's something wrong and bad about that. And I want to liken this to something that maybe you could identify with, because that almost sounds kind of hard to grasp. Especially in animation, but this is also a field in robotics, there's what they refer to as the uncanny valley. You ever watched a movie that shows computer animated people and they creep you out?
Mm-hmm.
They've got like those dead eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Like, as they become more and more detailed, they get closer and closer to real humanity. But because they're not there, they actually are more upsetting. You know, a hand-drawn figure like Snow White from the 20s is lovely and everyone, oh, that's very sweet. But then you have this super highly detailed computer-rendered figure, and it just kind of, we have this weird sensation. And it's been studied not just through animation robotics, it's been studied through psychology, and they refer to it as the uncanny valley, because it's this graph that says the closer that something gets to having a human-like appearance without actually being human, the more it creeps us out. There's a fish that looks like it has human teeth, and it made the rounds on Facebook a couple of months ago, where they open this fish's mouth. It looks like a normal fish, but you open its mouth and it looks like human teeth. Like, ah! I mean, it's super creepy. Why? Because it's almost human, but it's not. And there's something within us that something is wrong. So he gives that story, but who is he talking about? Do you know? You remember? It's not actually talking about the White Witch, though it applies to her. He gives that reference about not trusting something that should be human but isn't. He gives it to somebody else. It's about somebody else. They're talking about Edmund.
Edmund.
Oh, yeah. Edmund. He should be human, but he's not. Don't trust him. Can't trust him. Now, that also absolutely applies to the White Witch. She says she's human, she looks human, she is not human. She comes from Lilith, and she comes from the Giants. So, and if any of you recall, when Edmund meets her, she's like way too tall.
Yeah.
And her beauty is almost unreal. Yeah. Like a porcelain doll beauty. It's just, it's almost too perfect.
Yeah. So does it mean that the humans, sometimes a human is not human because they are so evil?
I think that's kind of what he's suggesting in this comment.
Yeah.
You can actually get rid of your humanity.
Right, like Scott Peck's book. People of the Lie. You ever read
that? I don't know the book, but the answer is probably yes.
Yeah.
You know, you become so degraded, you actually lose your humanity. Now, interestingly enough, I remember very, very clearly my New Testament professor, good godly man. I don't exactly remember where we got into this, but it's what he said. He hated people saying, "I'm only human." Why? When do you say that? When do you hear somebody say, "I'm only human"?
Made a mistake.
You've done something wrong. You've done something bad. You've hurt somebody's feelings. You have sinned. Well, I'm only human. And no. When you do that, you are something less than human. For Christ, there is full and true humanity in Jesus, and he never did that. So don't go blaming your humanity. It was a choice, and it's not this inexorable, "Oh, I couldn't help myself." You are actually acting less than a human when you sin. Our sin pulls us not only away from God, our sin pulls us away from true humanity. And the more we're pulled away, the less human we are.
Oh, and the creepier,
The devil.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So let's catch up with a little sneak. He has had a miserable go of it, and he's even considered turning around a couple of times. Why did Edmund not go back? You know he wanted to.
Turkish delight.
Okay, the promised Turkish delight.
And getting even with Peter.
Yeah.
And it's like every time the snow hit him on the head, who did he blame?
Right. Peter.
Ooh, I'm going to fix him.
To pay Peter out for college.
Now, this is probably impossible to identify with because no one else starts to sin and justify their sin because other people have been mean to them. That's never happened to any of you.
Of course.
Okay. All right.
You're right. Sometimes.
I'm glad you think so.
You know, I'm going to show this. I can very clearly imagine myself in the middle of something, and I knew I shouldn't do it, but you pushed me too far. You made me do that, or this will show you, or whatever it is. And it's this self-justification. And he self-justifies every step of the way. And we get the impression a couple of times he might want to turn back. And at just that moment, he comes up with a reason. Ugh! And off he goes. Now, he wants to be king. He wants his brothers and sisters to have their comeuppance. Does he want them destroyed?
No.
Has that even entered into his thoughts?
No, not really.
They'll have to serve him.
Yeah, he's got this very childish fantasy of, you know, when I'm dead, you'll be sorry. You know, I'm gonna go out there and I'm gonna die, and you're gonna come to my funeral and you're gonna cry, and then you'll, you know, that kind of like, don't you understand that when you're dead, you aren't gonna benefit from people? No, because they're kids and they don't get it.
They don't.
So he has this fantasy in his head that he is going, it's going to be this great comeuppance. And everyone who has given him a hard time, everyone who has been so rotten to him, well, he'll show them. Because with the queen, he will be the prince, and then he will be the king, and they will have to beg and grovel and blah, 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 blah. And he starts thinking about all the things he's going to do once he's king. Oh, I'm going to make a road over here.
Yeah, he's going to make a lot of roads because he's had a rough time.
It's been bad. But when I'm king, I'm going to fix it.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be mass transit and all this stuff. And he starts, you get the impression that that's how he's kind of able to make this nasty journey is through his imagination of how he's going to fix it. Yeah. Once I'm in charge,
we're
going to get rid of all this junk.
And the queen's going to be really nice.
That's right. That's right. But at some deep, dark level, does he know who she really is?
Yes.
Yeah. He's justifying in his head, like, oh, they're just on the other side, and so they're making stuff up about her to make her sound bad. But deep down in his heart, he knows, but he doesn't stop. He doesn't stop.
Uh-uh.
And he goes all the way, and he makes it to the house, and what does he see in the house?
He sees a lion.
Statues, including a lion. He sees a lion and he immediately thinks
it's Aslan.
That terrifies him until he realizes it's a statue, and then what does he think?
Aslan's
already become a statue. We've already won. What was I worried about?
Yeah. Right.
And what does that little snot do?
He draws on him.
Like only a little snot would do. It's the most childish, most obnoxious thing that he has to draw a mustache. And then little spectacles.
Yeah.
You little snot.
Yeah.
So he sees all these animals. He sees statues. They seem to be like in mid-movement.
Yeah.
And what is he realizing? These are all that the queen has turned to stone.
Mr. Tumnus is pretty sure,
and he looks
sad.
Sad.
Yeah.
Mr. Tumnus has now been a statue too. And if he can just get past this statue of a wolf sitting here on the doorstep.
Yeah. Instead, try to step
down
over.
Not a statue! That one was alive. So, remember who ransacked Mr. Tumnus's house?
That wolf.
Yeah, the secret police did, and Maugrim is the chief of the secret police.
Yeah.
So he goes and sees the queen, he relays the message. What's the message that Edmund wants her to have? Like, this is, because he's probably peed his pants because a wolf almost ate him. But to try to save his own life, he says he's got this important message for the queen.
They're in Narnia.
So the wolf brings him to the queen, and the queen is happy or unhappy to see him.
Unhappy because he came by himself. Murderously unhappy.
And what did she want?
She wanted all four at once. Yeah.
But he said they're close.
But they're close.
Yeah, right.
And he told
right.
Him.
Now, this is her prince and soon to be king. And what does she do is find as soon as she finds out that they're in Narnia and they're close?
She orders the dwarf.
Ignores him completely.
Yeah.
Oh.
He is a non-factor.
Yeah.
She's not even listening to him anymore. But she orders a dwarf, get the sled,
and don't
no bells.
But you did find out from him that Aslan is coming.
This is a stealth mission. She finds out Aslan's name has been invoked. So she is not going to waste any time.
That's why she wants to hurry.
She wants to go, and she wants to go now. She will run silently and secretly, but they are going to run fast, and they are going to run hard. Because they are going to catch these children, and then she will have all four in her grasp. Once she has all four in her grasp, what's going to happen?
Well, she'll do away with them, and then the four thrones will never
That's
be occupied.
Whatever she does, stone, murder, whatever, but she will make sure that those four thrones in Kir Paravel are never filled. Because if they're never filled, she will reign supreme.